Hey guys, welcome to Taste of Recovery, the podcast,
where we explore one's honest journey of surrender, willingness, acceptance, and courage.
I'm Alicia Spenlove.
And I'm Eden Sassoon.
Please join us every week for authentic and raw conversations with inspiring people in recovery.
We invite you and our guests to get real because the disease of addiction does not discriminate.
Oh, no, it doesn't. And we go through so many emotions. We laugh, we cry, we pray.
So get ready for a taste of recovery.
If you made a decision, action will follow. If there's no action, you really didn't make the decision.
Hey, y'all. Let's welcome Brian to the studio today.
Enjoy his taste of recovery.
My father, who was a World War II veteran, heavy drinker, he was a very conservative guy, but he, at that time, he said to me, meaning the war, he said, I don't know if this one's for us, you know? And, I didn't want to go, but I thought, okay, let me go. If you went, it was for 2 years. If you enlisted, it became a 3-year thing. And if you wanted to go to a particular theater like Europe or Italy or something like that, you had to enlist for 4 years and then you could miss Vietnam. So.
Wow.
I thought, I'll take my chances. So I enlisted. I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, I did. I went in, I took my draft time. It's like, okay, take me at the end of August. They did. When I got down there to North Carolina for basic training, they said, you know, for an extra year, you can get this job training for stock control and accounting. I thought, well, those guys aren't shooting anybody. So. I'll do that, you know? So I did that. And I went to, I was in Fort Bragg, North Carolina. Then I did, Fort Lee, Virginia for 10 weeks or something like that. I forget. And, I barely had 6 months and I got orders to go to Vietnam. And, so I went.
Were you drinking at this point?
My drinking started in like sophomore year of high school.
Okay.
And there were two scenarios. One was my father sat down with him. He was in the liquor business. So he sat down with me with a single malt scotch and an ice cube. And he said, here, and I just sip and put a glass of water there. He said, I want you to learn how to drink here, not out there. Well, of course, I don't know if it was around that time. I was out with a bunch of these guys who had a case of, Colt 45 malt liquor. Mm. I went to take the drink and my loud, rational voices in the front of my head were like, this is a great idea. And you're going to the dance and you love the dance. It's going to be fantastic. And there was one little quiet voice way in the back going, no, please don't do this. You know, and of course I didn't listen to that. And I had a great time. I was not a blackout drinker right away. You know, it was like a vine wrapping around something that was ultimately going to choke it. And so I liked it. But what was happening at that time through high school was it kind of reinforced my sort of not antisocial behavior. I just didn't want to be in school. I didn't like it. I wasn't good at it. I had a bad reading problem. My decisions regarding people, places, and things began to shift. Mm. And so I was attracted more and more to guys and gals who drank. Or, you know, and then marijuana was just coming on the scene. So that was around and it was a real taboo on that at the time. But then, you know, the war wasn't going away. It got more intense. And then some of the anti-war stuff was coming up in a bigger way. So I ended up going in the summer of 68 and went to Vietnam March of 69. Yeah, I was a squad leader in both, basic and advanced individual training. Then when I got to Vietnam, I was a sergeant in like 3 months or something like that. So I wasn't even in the army a year and I had some rank and, I didn't drink that much. I had responsibility.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I took that pretty seriously and that responsibility meant looking out after guys. When I got home from Vietnam, that's when I had my first, I had my first daily drinking. I got back. I wasn't even conscious of it. I didn't know I had been forever changed, as I would learn to say later, but I was drinking and anything that was in front of me to put on my nose or smoke or any of that stuff. So all that was in play for the year between Vietnam and college. And that's when I got in some trouble, scared my girlfriend, scared my parents. I wasn't that violent. I mean, I never hit my girlfriend or anything like that, but if I felt like I was cruising for a bruising, I had these hard shoes I would wear that laced so they wouldn't come off my feet. And a couple times I had this one jacket I would wear, and I put little pieces of razor blades in the lapel. So if somebody tried to grab me, you know, they, whatever. And, total madness. And, got in trouble. I was back 2 weeks, and, I wasn't 21, but I had this ID with my picture on it, and they put the day and the month you're born on the front and the year you're born on the back. So nobody really looked at it, you know, or I just, let's see some ID. And I pull it out very confidently, and they look, see the, oh, okay. Yeah. What do you want, son? And I went to this one place. Guy said, got a six pack of Michelob. And he said, let me see some ID. I said, oh yeah, here you go. And I hold it up, but he took it. He looked at it and he got mad. He threw it at me. He said, come back when you're 21. Mm-hmm. I snapped. I hadn't had anything to drink that day. And I went into a rage that I still don't understand to this day. And it was kind of a blackout rage. So I don't know. I guess I'd thrown some chairs around, and but I came to in handcuffs in the back of a police car, and I was banged up. I was not Rambo or the Incredible Hulk. No, that wasn't happening. So, but I did whatever. I terrified whatever the owner and the people there, and the policeman next to me. He just said to me, when did you get back? I was like, how does he know? And it's like, I said, oh, a couple of weeks ago. I was annoyed, and I said, and I had looked at the handcuffs. I said, oh, am I in trouble? And he said, yeah, you're in trouble. And you're still in the military. What the fuck? He said, I'm going to help you out, but you got to do what I tell you to do. I said, okay, what is it? He said, I'm taking you into disorderly conduct. And I balked, and he said, shut the fuck up. He says, the owner wants to charge you with assault and battery. Now here's what's going to happen. You're going to come back here next week with me. You're going to apologize to him, and you will pay for damages. I said, okay. So I did that next week. I went back with him, apologized very reluctantly, and then I gave him a check for $215 or something like that, which is a lot of dough back then. What happened that sort of started put things in motion, because I was going like this. I was just spiraling down in those months after Vietnam, and I was drinking pretty much every night. And I was out with two of my friends from high school who managed to dodge the draft. And I didn't care that they did that. I had no judgment about it. But we got stoned, and we drank some tequila, and we were high and whatever. It's 2 o'clock in the morning. Oh, let's go to New Jersey and get some wings. So we drive across the river and go into this all night wings place. And we're standing there eating these wings, and then this man and woman come in, and they're arguing, and it gets physical, and there's guys there, and they throw him out. And it was 2 minutes later, he's back with a pistol. And he shoots her twice in the chest.
Whoa.
Right in front of us. And this is where I still had that thing in me where my two friends were like holding their wings looking at this thing. And I just grabbed them both by the scruff of the neck and pulled them out of there. I said, we got to get out of here. What are you doing? What are you guys doing? So anyway, it was maybe the next day. I was in my car and I just went, you know, I can't do this with my life. Cause I was really, even then I knew I was like, I'm on a suicide path or something like it. And
you were 20 at this point.
Yeah. And then I decided to, I'd give college a try. So I went to the local community college, and I took a reading course with this professor who was another guardian angel who basically changed my life. So then I started school my first year, and the drinking and drugging I'd been doing between Vietnam and college just suddenly calmed down. And I'd drink beer on the weekends or something like that, or smoke a joint once in a while. I wasn't buying anything, but, college just changed everything. And I got into a theater class at the beginning of my second year, and that changed everything again. Terrified me, but I really, I liked it. And I thought, I think I want to do this. You know, I didn't know I was going to make a career of it, but at the time, it's like, I thought, wow, if this is what I'm going to do in school, I'm down for it. And, I loved my life. And I really thought the war was behind me. Like, it's gone. You know, I found a new normal, you know, reason for living, all that stuff. Then I moved to New York in 75, and, the X-rated people that were around me between Vietnam and college started to reemerge, if you will. I found that I got on that frequency again. Mm. So I was working in a restaurant, and I liked the drinking and all the stuff that went with it. And I was a bartender, and I thought this was great. I felt like I had arrived. I was making money. And this went on for a couple of years. And I was working. I worked in a Northern Italian place for 4 months. And then I worked in Soho, which was really happening at the time.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. And so yeah, that was really, everything was going on there. And so that's when I got introduced to cocaine. And that went on for a couple of years. And then the party started to wear off. And what was surprised me was I started having nightmares about the war.
Wow.
And it just, they wouldn't stop. I found myself in these dreams going back to Vietnam as a soldier, and that I had re-enlisted, which is unthinkable. Mm. And I get back to my unit, and none of the guys, my guys, remember me. Mm. And then I start like yelling. Then I'm crying. It's like, they don't remember me. There was another version of it where I went back and a couple of them were dead and a couple of them were alive. Mm. And it was just like, holy shit. So, I went and got, this is the first time I asked for help. It was like, yeah. I learned that with the fellowship. That's the most important thing we can do is ask for help. That theme is never ending for me with problems as they come up. Sometimes I can figure stuff out myself. And if I can't, I go and ask somebody to help me.
That's a great quality.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when I went through, I started working with this guy, Larry. He was a psychoanalyst. I trusted him. He confronted me first session. He said, have you been drinking? And I assured him that I wasn't. And he said, well, I smell something. Mm-hmm. I said, oh, wow. I had a couple beers and a Sambuca at lunch, but that's not really drinking. Is this? No, that's drinking. I said, no, let me tell you what I did the night before. You know, and the blow and everything else. And, but he's basically said, look, I'm not going to work with you, unless you go to AA. That was the first time anyone had ever said that to me. And I thought, AA, no, I'm not going to, no, that's crazy. I said, and I'm thinking with my history, I thought, well, everything calmed down when I went to college. We can do this again. I said, look, well, let's work on my problems. And, you know, you'll see this stuff will diminish. And he had no 12-step background at all. So it was, he said, all right. But he said, if it's coming into here, it's all, you know, you're done. I said, fine. And I made sure I never drank around a session or got high or anything like that. And, he made a difference. And so things did calm down. I was drinking less. And, long story short, I got my first acting jobs and professional jobs in Central Park in New York. That was it. My career started. And interestingly enough, I was really disciplined. I didn't, you know, through rehearsal periods with different plays and stuff like that, I really wouldn't drink after opening night. Yeah, I'd throw a few back, do a line, smoke a joint, whatever. And then in 84, I got into a hit play and I had a good part. And then for whatever reason, I started drinking after every show. Mm-hmm. I couldn't stop. Mm. We were going to go to London to take the play to London. And I said, okay, well, I'm going to put the brakes on. I'm just going to stop. And I did. And then I was detoxing in London. Thank God it was like 4 days we had before we had to start getting the play back up. Cause I was basically sleeping 15 hours a day, you know, cause I was getting all this booze out of my system. and stuff like that. But I had no education about alcoholism or addiction. So someone handed me a joint and smoke it, right? Mm-hmm. Okay. Mm-hmm. And that's the beginning of what was I would call the Brian program, which is not a very good program. Mm-hmm. And I don't recommend it to anybody. And that would go on for the next couple of years. So I came into AA in 88. But the year before that, in 87, I worked on a TV movie in Canada with a guy out here when I was in New York. And because I wasn't drinking, he thought I was in AA. And I said to him, I lied to him. I said, I've tried it a few times. It's not for me. I said, I just don't want it in my life, this stuff, you know. And he's like, oh, okay. And so he talked to me like we were. And then he was coming to New York and he said, well, let's get together, have some dinner. I said, oh, fine. So he calls me up. He goes, meet me at 79th Street and First Avenue, which if you're in AA, you know, that's where the 79th Street workshop is. And I didn't know. I said, yeah, we're going to eat on the Upper East Side. So I go and meet him there and there's all these people outside. He starts walking me in. I said, what are you doing? He said, we're going to a meeting. I said, I thought you just went to a meeting. Oh, no, we're going to do this. You've done this before, right? And I lied again. I said, yeah. So we went into the meeting and there's like 70, 80 people in there. And I'm looking around the room and I'm going, oh my God, they let anybody in here, you know? And then there were people who were like really dressed up coming from mm-hmm. work. There were some homeless people eating cookies over in the corner. And there's a guy up there talking and, I just didn't know what to do. But what I was left with was there was an energy of honesty that I went, wow, wait a minute. There might be something here. Fast forward, because over the next year, it was like I could get through 2-3 months without doing anything. Mm-hmm. And then I didn't know if I was going to have a drink in my hand. I didn't know if I was, sometimes I planned it. Finally, in November on Veterans Day, which I was unconscious of. I didn't even think about it. A friend of mine came down from the Upper West Side and he said, I lived in the West Village. He said, well, I'm going to come out and have a drink with, you don't drink anymore. I said, no, I'll have a coffee with you. Don't worry about it. The next morning I had a huge, second appointment for a film with these producers and this director. And, I went to meet my friend, and we sat at the bar. And I went, you know what? I think I'll have a Jack Daniels, but I'm only going to have one. And sure enough, 3:30 in the morning after a few lines and a lot of Jack Daniels,
jeez.
I went, oh my God, I got 4 hours to sober up. And so I went home. I took a cold shower, a hot shower. I drank coffee, which I don't drink anymore. I drank all the stuff. I couldn't shake the buzz. I was really high. And then I'm getting hungover and I'm high at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I go in to meet these people and there were four of them and I could see the looks on their faces as I tried to pretend. Mm. I tried to act perfectly, like I'm okay. You know, and it was like, no, I wasn't okay. If there were bubbles over their heads, it was like, how do we get this guy out of here? But I called up a friend of mine that day because it doesn't sound like, I didn't crash a car. You know, I didn't do anything horrible, but it was a straw that broke the camel's back. Mm. And I went to my first meeting that night. But then I didn't declare my birthday anniversary until the following week because I kept going to meetings and like I was suspicious, scared, mm-hmm. Judgmental. Mm-hmm. And then I got to, it was the 19th, which I would say what's your sobriety date? I'd say November 19th, 1988. And I was walking across the village to go to this meeting I'd been to the week before. And I could feel those voices I described when I first drank. And they just turned around. Mm. The loud, rational ego voice, this is a great time, you're going to drink, blah, 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 went into the back seat of the car, and the quiet voice came up front and said, give this thing a shot. Mm. So I got my first sponsor that night, and then the path started. And I had what I would call a meeting-based sobriety for the first couple of years. I really enjoyed the fact that the obsession had been lifted. I wasn't, no more planning.
How old were you when you got sober?
38 or 39. Mm. And plus I became a gym rat for a couple of years. Then I did that thing and I've seen it in the rooms where, you know, I started to feel like, I don't know if I want to be around these people so much. And You know, I could cut back and, you know, I'm not drinking and I'm doing fine. And there were a couple guys that were just pretty smart and just started, they picked up on it. And one guy in particular, a guy, I didn't like him actually. He was way too clear. You know, he just had his stuff together and just, he knew the principles inside and out. And, but he started looking more and more interesting. And I got him to be my sponsor. That's another story. But anyway, he.
I'm like, yeah. Yeah.
But then we started in on, step one, in a formal way with the literature. And,
Wait, can you go into that for a moment? Because step one is huge for me every day.
Yeah.
And I don't think that enough people talk about it. So if you would be willing, I would love
to hear. Bottom line for me, and it still is, with step one, is it's an honesty step. My admission of my alcoholism, my powerlessness was going to be really important in terms of being able to build what would follow. The other thing I needed to do too, because I hated calling myself an alcoholic. I didn't like it, you know. It took me a while to get comfortable with that. I had trouble with the language for quite a while. Mm-hmm. But, the more I started to do the work with my sponsor, he got me to write out my drink and drugging history from first to last and read that to him. And I remember I read it to him in one of our meetings and he said, based on this, do you think you're powerless? And I said, yep, I am. I get it. What's beautiful about it is, and this is the miracle or wonder of the 12-step template, is there's a drift. There was a natural drift for me to move into two. So that if there's this emptiness I'm experiencing from step one, what's next? I came to believe. Mm. I went, oh, I really understand that arc. Mm. Okay. And so, as it says in the big book, my spiritual awakening or experiences was really of the educational kind. Mm-hmm. It was what I learned and witnessed with others in the rooms, allowed myself to be witnessed, the intimacy of creating a trust bond and adopting principles with my sponsor, mm-hmm. and then paying attention to people who were on that frequency as well. And so, one of the things that came up for me with step two was the whole notion of some kind of faith. Synonymous with trust and that, so that there was something that was going to fill this emptiness that I relinquished myself of. And I started to build on that. And part of how I did that, because I still had this skepticism going on, was my sponsor at the time said to me, come back next week with, an evidence list, which I said, okay, what's that? He said, well, the words used a couple times, it's in 12 and 12. He said, bring in a list of the things, people, places, and things in your life that you believe are, have to do with truth, beauty, or goodness. Oh, okay. So I come back the next week. I had this list of everything from sunrises and sunsets to oceans and children and laughter and music, etc. And I read all that to him and he said, which were magic words for me. He said, do you think there might be something behind that? And there was like a click. I went, yeah, I do. I believe that. So it really set me up with this whole idea that I could come up with my own concept of a power greater than myself, which was going to come up in the steps to follow. So then here I get the three, I call that a hope step because the possibilities that would come out of three were surprising. I remember asking my sponsor, I said, how do I know I've made a decision? He said, if you made a decision, action will follow. Mm-hmm. If there's no action, you really didn't make the decision. Mm-hmm. So he went like that. And that was like an understanding of the third step that was going to be transformational. Because now I had with those first three steps, now I was ready to go to, if I called step one an honesty step, step four was going to be a greater call for honesty. Now I'm going to put stuff that's in here or wherever. I'm going to put it on paper and it's going to be in this world. It's going to be in the physical world. And I followed the guidance of my sponsor and went through the three inventories. This fourth step inventory became a kind of this collage that was like really helping me make sense of who I was as an alcoholic and a human being and a man. I did the fifth step. I finished that and he said, okay, it's going to suggest here that you go home and take an hour to reflect on this. So will you do that? I said, yeah, I'll do that. So I left there. I sat there for almost an hour and I wrote one sentence. I wrote, "Dear God, I did the best I could." Mm. And that was my epiphany to understand that as an untreated alcoholic addict, I'd been doing the best I could with what I had. I didn't have spiritual tools. I didn't know till later that I was spiritually bankrupt when I came to AA and that what I was building was a spiritual condition. It was the first time I experienced forgiveness. I felt it. And then when I got to six, it was all about, I call it grace. The next epiphany, if you will, was realizing my part of my alcoholism, which was my selfishness and my self-seeking, my dishonesty, my fears, all of that, like that. Now I was going to go into this partnership with my higher power that was going to be even more intimate. Seven was based on what I'd learned about myself. I was able to ask for the stuff that was recognizable, that I knew was a problem, that I could get aid from. And then here it come to eight, and it's like I'm putting together this list of people that I believe I had harmed. There were a handful of people to deal with from Vietnam, and the guy, this was a huge situation. He was on my list, and he was my commanding officer, and we hated him, and he was an awful human being, or that's what I thought at the time. And so I thought, no way, that guy, no, I'm not making amends with him, you know, after what he did, the way he treated us, etc. I called the number, and I thought, I hope this is the right number. I hope this is the right guy. And sure enough, the answering machine picks up, and it's his voice. And I went, oh, that's him. I was like in a sweat. I was like, no, I'm not leaving a message. I want to talk to him. So I called the next day, and I got him on the phone, and I said, is this Mr. So-and-so? And he said, yeah, who's this? I said, this is Brian Dellett. I was in your unit in 1969. In Chu Lai, Vietnam. And and he was like, well, not sure who you are. I said, I was the one responsible for the grenades because two of my men tried to kill him. And I let them keep the grenades. I mean, I'm very lucky I didn't get more trouble. Mm. But they tried to kill him. They didn't. They ended up getting tried for attempted murder. They went from Vietnam to Fort Leavenworth for 4 years or something like that. But anyway, I said, I was the one responsible for the grenades. And that's when he knew who I was. And he goes, what do you want? I said, I'm making contact because I've had an opportunity to reflect on my behavior from that time. And, I didn't bring up AA at first. I brought it up later, but I said, I wanted to make contact because I wanted to see if there was some way to address any harm I may have caused you. And if so, I wanted to implore your forgiveness and do whatever it takes to rectify this. And he was impressed, I think. He said, oh, he got sincere. He said, was there any harm I caused you? And I said, just want to take care of my side of things. I didn't want to say, why do you think we tried to kill you? But anyway, we had a really sincere conversation, about 20 minutes. He said, look, he says, if there's any harm I caused you, I hope you can forgive me. I said, absolutely, sir. He says, if you're ever out here, maybe we can have a cup of coffee. I said, yeah, okay. Hung up the phone, and I was frozen for I don't know how long. I just couldn't believe what had taken place. I couldn't believe, and that's why I call nine the perception's step, if you will. And that was like, oh my God, it was just so powerful. And, you know, because he was an authority figure. I rebelled. I didn't like the way he treated people or me or people around me. It was just all that. But then it was the miracle of being able to see that there is this divinity that's in every man, woman, and child. And when that's recognizable, all kinds of possibilities mm-hmm. can happen. And then when I had a huge reaction to 9/11, and I was downtown under the first plane, and all this war stuff came up. And what was really scary was I felt like there was an earthquake that hit my program. Like, I thought, oh my God, I could feel parts of me going back to where, some of the self-criticism and this and, you know, shame and all this stuff started coming up. And I thought, wait a minute, I did all this work. What's going on? And again, I had to ask for help. So I went to the VA and I got another guardian angel. I got this guy, Steve, who was my counselor for like the next 14 years. And then from that, I started taking my PTSD into the theater world and entertainment stuff. AA, the 12-step template, really made a difference in terms of how I had no idea I was going to become a peer mentor for veterans. Because like after 2003 and the whole Iraq thing, these guys started coming home, and it's still a problem today with the suicide rate with veterans. And a lot of them are coming out of these last two wars. Yeah. So, but the beautiful thing about the 12-step template was I was able to take that, the energy of that work into helping another veteran. Like we and us that are in 12-step fellowships, part of our recovery is sharing our stories with each other. And that's what the trust is a huge issue in the veterans community. But then there's nothing like, you know, one alcoholic winning the confidence of another. Well, the same thing takes place with the veterans community. And it was like, I think because, I was older. I was from the previous war. There was something about the healing that took place or could take place. And so, in many instances when I was still back east, it would be like, these guys would be on these different meds, these anti-anxiety meds and all this other stuff. And they were drinking and drugging. And, I'm not a professional, but my gut feeling was like, you got to stop putting this junk in your body.
Yeah.
You got to stop that, you know, and then deal with your PTSD. I mean, there's nothing like, we've all experienced, or a lot of us have experienced what they call dual diagnoses, where you have one problem, then you have another, and then you have them both, and you got to deal with them. Mm. Beautiful thing was, it kind of reinforced things with my program, with my AA program. I kind of doubled down on that again. Mm. I went further with step 11, with meditation, and that started to become a much more important component than I would do it, but there wasn't the same dedication that would come up as it did these last years. So I went back to Vietnam the second time, and when I went the first time, I really thought they were going to arrest me when I got off the plane. I saw their soldiers there in the airports and stuff. Just, you know, they're just standing there. But I thought, oh, they know who I am. I'm done. And it was complete opposite. They were so welcoming. It was unbelievable. Anyway, I go back the first trip with my wife, and then I got introduced to the cultural ministers, and then the next thing you know, it's like it's starting to take shape. The second trip was all about setting up the play and doing it with one of their actresses. And that play had to do with PTSD, combat, suicide ideation. And so on the second trip, I flew down from Hanoi and I went down to stand on the ground where I had seen a lot of people get hurt and where I fought. And it was right by the ocean. And I was with a Vietnamese driver and a translator. And I still had the hardwiring of like, I don't trust these people. Mm. You know, they tried to kill me at one time. And you don't let go of that stuff very easily. And even with all the work I'd done with recovery, I still had that knot that wasn't going to go away. Mm. But what happened was I was there. We got down to this one place that was near this lagoon that we used to swim in when I was there as a soldier. And I could feel that thing again with step 11. I said, I think I need to step away, you know, from these two Vietnamese men. And I went over and I got on my knees and, I was just quiet for a couple minutes. I didn't know if I was praying or meditating, to be honest. But then what happened was I felt the whisper of a voice, which was the guys who did not get back. And they were saying, we're okay. And so are you. And something shifted. And I started to see the humanity of these people who once terrified me. Huge, huge, huge. And it's all from recovery. It's just amazing. And then I went back the last trip I did, which was within a year after that. And I did that play Memorial Day in Hanoi for 2 nights in front of the former enemy. And, wow. There was nothing like it. There was my translator was just, she's smaller than Eden. Korean, but she was a language savant. She'd never been out of Vietnam and she could hold a conversation with us now in English. And she was 22 and she knew Japanese, Vietnamese, English, and Russian.
Wow.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. But she was in between myself and these veterans, and some of them were women veterans. And we embraced, they would hug and they'd say something in Vietnamese and she would say to me, he said humanity, he said humanity, he said compassion, he said compassion, you know, and it went on like that. And so little did I know that AA would take me in that journey to where after 9/11 and PTSD reared its head like never before, little did I know that my program was going to be a profound influence to move me past that dark history of myself. And there's a quote, I use it in the play from Ernest Hemingway, which is, the world breaks everyone, and afterward, many are stronger in the broken places. Mm-hmm. And that's what I've gotten to witness. That's why I'm in meetings, I'll say, I just like the attitude of that sort of saying.
I love that saying. It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
But I was going to say too that journey, the parallel, the divine convergence of my recovery and my war history, I never would have imagined that they would come together and have this impact
and create such beautiful art.
Yeah. Yeah.
And communication between two different cultures that
exactly. Yeah.
Have probably the same nightmares with different, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the
visions.
I'm so blessed because there was one incident when my wife went with me in 2012. I was a little shaky on that first trip and I was with 7 other veterans, this guy, Dr. Tick, and his wife and another psychologist and a widow who lost her husband there. And we went to everybody's location. We didn't get to the place where I needed to be exactly. We were nearby. It was the second trip, like I was explaining before, where I went and stood on the ground, that ground. So it was a 3-week trip and my wife and I were in a very nice hotel in this city called Hoi An in what was used to be South Vietnam. And there was a busboy or someone come by and asked if I wanted more tea, and we made eye contact. The second we made eye contact, I felt what I call an emotional tumor rose to the surface. And it was like I was going to throw up, but it was an emotional throw up, if you will. I said to my wife, I'll be back. I went outside and I wailed for 15 minutes or something. I don't know. I came back in and she said, what was that? What would happen? What was that all about? And I said, well, in whatever, 9 months into my tour, we came in from a night job. We were out looking for, we'd set up these, what they call ambushes, where we try and catch these, their version of a commando they called sappers, who would try and get in and blow stuff up. And we try and catch them and kill them. So this one night we had I had a crazy guy in my squad. He wasn't fit to be in the field, but they put him with me, right? So he's like, it was almost dark. It was dusk. And he said, they're watching us. He said, don't look, don't look. He said, I said, well, how do you know? He goes, I'm telling you, they're watching us. He said, we got to move the trip flares. We got to move the Claymore mines over there. I said, and something said, okay. All right. Yeah. All right. Let's do it. So we move all this stuff as it gets dark. And sure enough, they came in where he said they would. There were, I think, 4 of them. We killed a couple of them. 2 of them got away. I was rattled. We were rattled. And so when it was time to fold up everything, put everything away, was when it got light. So we were coming in from that, and we were coming through the main gate of the of the compound. We called them Vietnamese cowboys. They were these young guys who didn't do anything. They didn't work. They tried to steal from you or they tried to sell you stuff. And I don't know how I looked at the guy. I must have looked at him derisively, but he spit in my direction. And kind of like the bar in Pennsylvania, I went nuts. Mm. And I beat him, horribly. I couldn't stop. And then I couldn't stop. And then I didn't have anything left in my arms. And I had these guys around. My own guys were like these. One guy tried to stop it. The other guys were like, he needs to get this out of his system. They were just jaded thugs. We all were in that, at that point. Mm. I remember walking away from that. And then the next day I felt horrible. Mm. And then I kind of put it away because other stuff was going on. And so I told my wife this whole story and, she was great. And she, the same busboy comes back, looks me in the eye. Would you like some more tea? And I said, yes. And I felt this peace. Mm. It was just really
wow,
amazing.
It's like your pain has turned into such beauty.
Mm. Thank you. That's been most of my experience too. Mm. It's like there's something about this idea of transformation. That's why I love that Hemingway quote. Mm. Is that we see that in recovery where we see people come in broken and then we see them come back together. Mm. You know, mm-hmm. Does it happen all the time? No, of course not. But when it does, it's inspiring. But all of these things come from me trying to destroy myself, to deal with life, to taking those destructive impulses and tendencies and moving them into actions that could be constructive, that could actually help the people around me and help me, you know. There's the things. So we hear that saying, like, we're going to love you till you learn to love yourself. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we should say, we're going to help you to love yourself so that you can love someone else. Mm. And we don't say that, of course.
But you said it and it's beautiful.
Yeah, it is.
Beautiful. Yeah, if there's something, if someone is out there really struggling and listening to you right now, what would you say to them?
Don't be afraid to ask for help. Please don't be afraid to ask for help. You know, there's help available. You just have to ask for it. Recognize the possibility that there is help out there. And don't believe the voice that tells you you're a bad person or you're a terrible person or your life's not worth living. Don't buy into giving up. I mean, we talk about the disease as cunning, baffling, and powerful. Yeah. That's how I saw the steps initially.
Mm,
they look cunning, baffling, and powerful.
Yes.
What am I supposed to do with that? How is that supposed to mean anything? I mean, on top of that, there was, I call it the language of recovery, which is what we're talking about today, or our vocabulary. Like, I never thought I was going to have a second language in my life, but this is my second language. That's why this one has to be worked on continually. Mm. I need to work on this. Mm. I need to hear what I've heard 100 times and go, oh, wow, you know, I think I heard that a little differently.
Yes.
You know?
See that even. What? Wow.
There's something about all of the slogans that like initially looked like this sort of written elevator music, like, first things first. Yeah, right.
Mm-hmm.
Easy does it. mm-hmm. You know, and a lot of cynicism. And over time, they all started to take on. First things first, it's like, you know, personalities, principles before personalities. I even did it today when I sat down with you guys. It's like, can I reach Eden and Alicia from my higher power to your higher power? Mm. Can my higher power recognize your higher power? Mm. And can our personalities be second to that? And if I do that, then principles before personalities has a shot.
Thank you so much for joining us. We hope these stories have touched your hearts and left you with a newfound appreciation for the incredible strength within us all.
And if you found our podcast to be a source of inspiration, we'd be extremely grateful if you could take a moment to rate and review us.
Yes, review us.
Your support helps us reach more people on the path to recovery.
And while you're at it, hit that follow button on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Remember, you're not alone. One day at a time, we got this.